It is Patriots Day, and as we heard from WBUR's Alex Ashlock, for the second year in a row, Boston will mark Patriots Day without the Boston Marathon. In the before times, you actually might hear folks calling today Marathon Monday more than Patriots Day, at least here in Boston. So today, as we celebrate Patriots Day, now for the second time without the marathon, we thought this would actually be a good opportunity to talk about what it is we are actually celebrating. What is the history of Patriots Day, and why are we so proud of it? So we've got two guests to tell us. Stacy Frazier is the Collections and Outreach Manager for the Lexington Historical Society, and Tom Putnam is the Executive Director of the Concord Museum. Stacy, Tom, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much.
Great to have you both. I love history. Gonna have some fun with this. Stacy, I'm gonna start with you. We have heard of the midnight ride of Paul Revere, you know, one if by land, two if by sea, shot heard around the world. I want you to narrow it down for us. Take us back to the beginning. The British regulars had been in Boston for years, but on April 18th, 1775, they decided to march to Concord. Why?
Well, there's a lot of people who have done a lot better work on this than I, but I'll give you the broad strokes, the elevator speech. Essentially, we're looking at the British troops in Boston being concerned about the amount of movement from local militias and local, the provincial Congress and committees of correspondence were really kind of, they were active, and the British troops had heard of a, they knew of a cache of munitions, some stolen cannon that had been taken by other militias from the British, and they knew that they were housed in Concord. So they basically decided to send out some patrols, send out a party, and see if they could take back the cannon and other material, war material, gunpowder and things like that. In sort of what they were hoping was kind of a secret overnight mission. They left, as we know, over in the evening. They packed about a day's rations. It wasn't intended to be a long excursion. It was intended to go, you know, hopefully be able to retake some stores and return. And as we know, that is not how it turned out.
Yeah. And not so secret, Tom, no. Right? So tell us briefly, give us again, the elevator pitch or speech of what happened next. What made this different from some of these other skirmishes?
Well, I think the lesson of those 24 hours is that the British had thought, the British Parliament, that this was some kind of rude rabble and that General Gage was ordered to kind of, put down this growing rebellion. And instead, what they found was a very well-disciplined, combat-ready militia. So when Revere gets to Lexington around midnight, the word goes out, the militia musters. And again, as people know, at 5:30 in the morning, when the British arrive, neither side was supposed to fire, but shot breaks out. And in the end, people die there on the green. The British regulars continue their march to Concord, as Stacy indicated. That's what the goal was, to find the munitions there. And there they meet an even larger force because, again, the word has gone out from Revere and other riders. So now in the famous battle at the North Bridge, there's actually 450 provincial troops mustering on one side of the bridge and only 100 because the British had broken up into smaller companies. So again, the British, it was a rude surprise to them. They take many casualties in Concord and even many more on the march back to Boston.
Okay, so a couple things here. First, listeners, oops, we're getting some feedback over the line. I think the folks in the control room will handle that for us. While they do, listeners, if you have questions about the history of Patriots Day, about what happened in that 24 hours, this is a really cool time to get to ask that question. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. Stacy Frazier, I'm going to turn to you. So if I understand this correctly, it really was, they just didn't think this was going to be that big a deal. If I'm not putting it too slothfully, and it turned out that the Minutemen, the rebels thought it was a very big deal. Is that fair to say?
I think so, yeah. I think there was a lot more communication amongst, there were some very, very well-spoken, very eager to communicate individuals in the area. You know, John Hancock, as we know, has connections both in Boston and in Lexington. Reverend Jonas Clark is the fiery minister in Lexington who has been preaching, you know, rebellion for quite a while now. There really was, and that's just Lexington, there really was a lot of support for standing up to what people at the time felt was not fair. You know, we were not being treated as full citizens. And I think that there was a lot more sentiment and a lot more organization than the troops were expecting, and certainly the commanders were expecting.
So,
And that's an interesting thing because, you know, as you said, it's not secret, and they realize that. You know, the British troops are not unaware of the fact that the countryside is alarmed. They are not going to pull off this secret thing. And you can tell there's a few moments where they're starting to, you know, say, okay, this could be something. We should maybe be concerned soon. You know, they send for reinforcements. They send a rider to Boston for reinforcements around 4 a.m., which is before fighting even starts on the green. They just know, you know, from seeing people up and about, from hearing bells and alarms in the towns they pass through, they know the jig is up and they know it's going to turn into something. So they send for reinforcements even before that, before the Battle of Lexington, because, you know, this is turning into a big thing.
So I want to stop and I want to jump in there and turn to you, Tom, because I watched the visualization of these 24 hours that the Concord Museum posted online, and it really is like watching swarms come in. I mean, they are, by the time this thing is done and they are retreating back to Boston, they are just hugely outnumbered.
It's 2 to 1, and I'm so pleased that you watched it. It's available online and in our museum if folks want to visit this week. The British start out with 700 troops, and as Stacy just indicated, then they call for reinforcements. So another 1,000 troops come and join them in Lexington on the return. But by the end of the day, they're outnumbered 2 to 1. So there's close to 3,400 local militia and minutemen. And what's also astounding is they come from as far away as Framingham, Newton, Roxbury, Danvers, and Lynn. I mean, these aren't easy places to walk, from to get to Lexington and Concord in time. And again, the image that you're referring to is our map shows this kind of big red column of the British troops, and then all of these blue troops represented by the local militia that are coming from every town in the area. Again, it shows once again this astounding level of resistance was built on careful planning and really a decade of mounting anger against the British Parliament and the King.
All right, so we've got some calls. Let's have a little fun with this. 800-423-8255 to ask your question. We'll start with Jessica. Sorry about that, is in the car in Boston. Jessica, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was just curious. You guys mentioned that when Paul Revere made it to Lexington, and I don't know if I learned this wrong, but I thought I learned when I was in high school that Paul Revere got arrested and that this guy Dawes made it and that he never made it to Lexington. So I guess my question is, did Paul Revere make it to Lexington or did he get arrested? And if not, who made it to Lexington?
Okay, Stacy is Lexington Historical Society. So Stacy, I'm turning to you.
I'll take it. Yeah, so Revere is a funny guy. Revere, you know, he basically made it to Lexington, to the home of Reverend Jonas Clark. It's now the Hancock Clark House that we interpret. It's open today and this weekend. And he got there because he knew Hancock and Adams were there. However, you are correct that along the way, he picked up some helpers, basically. William Dawes and Samuel Prescott both joined in. And you are correct that just outside of the downtown of Lexington, in a spot that's now in the National Park, he was caught by a patrol of British officers and he was held and his horse taken. So it is actually Dawes that makes it on, Dawes and Prescott that make it on from there and warn other towns. Revere does make it to Lexington, but he doesn't make it all the way to Concord. So the many militia groups that Tom mentions that are massing in Concord wouldn't necessarily have been there if, you know, Revere had gotten caught just outside of Lexington and never made it all the way to Concord.
Okay,
My
so
favorite part too of the story is that he also has to walk back when they released him. They had caught him and a few other militia scouts, basically. And when they started hearing gunfire, they released them and let them walk back. So, you know, Paul Revere leaves Lexington on a horse bound fast for Concord with important messages. And he comes back to Boston or to Lexington around 2:30 in the morning on foot, just out of the game at that point, unfortunately.
All right. So let's get one now for Tom. We've got Karen on the line in Dedham. Karen, go ahead with your question.
Hi there. I'm calling because a local publishing company called Charles Bridge is putting out a book called Why Longfellow Lied, The Truth About Paul Revere's Midnight Ride. And I'm wondering what you two make of the fact that Longfellow really made up some history 100 years, 60 years later, that didn't really happen and made Revere a hero.
Tom.
Oh, well, you could tell that story in a more admirable way. So Longfellow was actually writing that poem right before the Civil War, and he was using it to inspire the citizens of his time to stand up for the rights and the ideals that our country stood for. But you are absolutely right. He took poetic license with the poem. So as Stacy just explained, Revere doesn't make it to Concord. In the poem, Longfellow, you know, has them make it to Concord. So it is a piece of poetry or fiction. You know, today we say inspired by true events. But the general note, you know, message of the poem, I think, has integrity and can be defended.
So Stacy and Tom, we are now in a moment where our cultural institutions, our historical institutions are necessarily and rightly beginning to grapple with our racial history, our history with slavery as a city. And I know both of your museums and the towns of Lexington and Concord are now grappling with and telling stories that maybe weren't a part of the history we celebrated about Patriots Day in the past. I'd love to hear from each of you about that, maybe starting with you, Stacy.
Absolutely. We're very, very happy to be starting a new project funded by the Foundation for Metro West. We're looking at particularly slavery in Lexington at the Hancock Clark House as a starting point, because it is one of our historic properties and because it's connected with such big names in the early days of the revolution, like John Hancock, Samuel Adams, people who really talked a lot about freedom and equality and liberty. And there is an inherent tension there of these kinds of ideals being expressed and being literally fought for on the town green, but enslaved individuals in town who are either fighting in the war or just present in town, and certainly I think would have some thoughts about some of the rhetoric. And I think a big part of that is trying to look at all of those sides of the perspective. You know, we know what Reverend Clark said about the battle. We know what Hancock and Adams said about the battle and about the Revolutionary War. What did Margaret, you know, an enslaved woman in Lexington who sued for her freedom towards the end of the war, what did that feel like for her, you know, to hear a lot of that language in the Declaration and in some of the early justifications for the start of the war? And I think it's an important thing to look at that. We're really happy that we have this project that's been funded. We're looking at the lives of two enslaved people who lived at the Hancock Clark House. Their names were Jack and Dinah. And we've told the stories for a long time. The Historic Society has been around since 1886. We've been telling doing a good job, I think, of telling the stories of John Hancock and Samuel Adams and a lot of the big names that we know of. But the whole story is not just that part of it. It's not just one of those narratives. And so I think we owe it to our community to really look at what did Lexington look like in 1775. Who were the Black men who were on the green that morning? You know, what did the community look like besides just the, you know, the men that we know of who were on the green that morning? And really kind of doing our due diligence and trying to do a better service to history by telling those stories of women and Black people and Native people who were involved in this effort as much, if not more sometimes, as the names we know.
Thank you, Stacy. Tom, how about at the Concord Museum?
Oh, well, again, I invite all the listeners to come visit. And in our opening gallery, there are two really extraordinary artifacts. The first a young 23-year-old Abner Hosmer, who heard the call go out from Revere and other writers. He was from Acton and woke up that morning, I'm sure not realizing it would be the last morning he would be on this earth. He was at the lead about to cross the bridge, and one of the two soldiers, the local militia, who died. But next to, and we on display, we have his powder horn, and it's just a very moving thing to be adjacent to this artifact that brings to life this one of the first people to give his life for these liberties. But adjacent to it, and as Stacy was saying, we too are doing our due diligence. So, you know, Concord at that time had a population of about 1,500 people, and there were at least 24 enslaved men, women, and children. Massachusetts doesn't abolish slavery until 1783. And we have a looking glass or a mirror that belonged to Casey Whitney. He was enslaved and by a gentleman named Samuel Whitney, who fought at the North Bridge. And so we are quite sure that Case Whitney was by his side. So in this looking glass or mirror, when Case Whitney was a young man, he would have seen the reflection of an enslaved person. But after fighting in the Revolution and for the Revolutionary Army, his enslaver, Samuel Whitney, emancipated him, gave him his freedom. So he lived, he was 43 at the time, and he lived another 30 or 40 years. And when he looked in that mirror, he would have seen a free man. So just that one artifact gives you that arc of that one individual's life. Extraordinary person whose story was often untold, and now, like the Lexington Historical Society, we're doing our best to be sure those unheard voices are speaking to us through time.
In a little bit of a lightning round, one thing, if listeners are piqued today to do more based on this history, one thing you might recommend that they check out. Stacy.
Just hoping it'll go second. so it's a tricky day because, you know, we're already at 3:38. This is around the time when the parades and things would be winding down and people would be starting to go home. But, you know, we do have, if people don't feel comfortable going out, we have video guided tours, and we have virtual 3D tours on our website of all of our historic houses that would normally be open. All three are witness houses to what happened that morning. And the 3D guided tours really let you look through the houses on your own pace and kind of see all those spaces. And then tomorrow, the weather looks beautiful. We have one of our few in-person events. We have a socially distanced scavenger hunt throughout Lexington. You meet at the depot building, you get, you know, your piece of paper and your pencils, and you go around with your family and you look for sites throughout town. And there's a prize if you win.
And Tom, lightning round to you. One thing people could do.
Sure. Well, again, I don't want to be too parochial, but I invite people to come. We have a new $1.2 million exhibit that tells the story of April 19th. And during COVID, we realized not everyone could come, so we've converted it to a microsite, and it's shotheardroundworld.com. So you take, or I'm sorry, .org. Take out the buzz. So it's not buzz shot heard round the world, but shotheardroundworld.org. You can find it on our website.
And we will actually post both of your organization's websites on ours at radioboston.org. That's Stacy Fraser, Collections and Outreach Manager for the Lexington Historical Society, and Tom Putnam, Executive Director of the Concord Museum. Stacy and Tom, thanks for educating us about Patriots Day.
Thank you.
Sure, it was fun.
Yep. Happy
Great to have you
Day.
Both.